Hi, it's Guy Raz from the TED Radio Hour. And when we interviewed Amanda Palmer a couple weeks ago, she told us this amazing story about how she came up with her TED Talk, how she spent weeks, months trying to put it together. That talk has been insanely popular. More than 2 million people have watched it in the 2 months since it was posted. And we couldn't fit the whole part of our conversation into the show, so we decided to post it here. Enjoy.
For 2 days, I had decided I had hit the jackpot idea. I had come up with it myself. I was going to do a 3-minute silent performance dressed in full makeup as the 8-foot bride with cards reminiscent of my Kickstarter video and explain to people what my life was like via the vehicle of the written word. And then, wait, it gets better. And then I was going to hop off the box, rip off my costume, wipe off my face, grab a ukulele, sing a 3-minute song about how I evolved into a musician from a street performer. And then I was going to wrap it all up, ditching the ukulele, running over to a piano. And it was going to be this like 3-part postmodern rock opera about love, trust, and crowdfunding.
Wow. And then I thought you were even maybe going to crowd surf like at TED, like jump into the audience?
Well, yeah, I thought about crowd surfing. I thought about and I actually got my Twitter feed all excited about this, and then I had to disappoint them. I had this idea that I would give part of the talk in front of a flashing screen of like 500 images of my fans naked at work with ukuleles covering their private parts. This is like what happens to Amanda Palmer's brain in the middle of the night. And I ditched all of these ideas. And actually, it was my friend Michael Pope, a filmmaker friend of mine, over dinner. So I was going through all of these permutations with my friends. And there's like 8 of us sitting around the kitchen table. And he said, Amanda, all this stuff sounds really exciting and fantastic and weird and interesting. And yes, we know you're a great performer and a great songwriter. But you get the most excited and the most animated you've been sitting at this table talking to us when you're just talking. You should really just talk.
But then to say what? Like, how did you know what you wanted to say?
Well, I gave a kind of a very rough sketch of this talk at Harvard about 2 or 3 years ago, where I wanted to explain to people simply why being a street performer educated me in the ways of allowing my audience to pay for music and giving it to them for free. And I looked around at all these other people so confused at my mentality, and I thought, well, my mentality evolved this way because I grew up in the street trusting strangers, and it worked. So I've had an experience and an education that these other people haven't had. I want to explain to them something that I learned.
Once you sort of figured out what you wanted to say, how did you sort of go about the process of putting it together? Like, what did you do?
Yeah, it was agonizing. The first thing I did, because it's a very Amanda Palmer thing to do, is I went into a couple of bookstores and I bought a bunch of books, none of which I wound up reading, really. But I sort of wanted to get inspired. So I went into some bookstores and I bought some books on digital copyright and the copy fight. And this is like the sort of the first week, and it was I'm going to write my TED Talk week. And then I started making notes in the back of a notebook as thoughts hit me. And, you know, I sort of did one giant brain dump saying I'm just going to talk about the salient points. What do I want to share with people? What's happened to me that's interesting? How can I connect street performance to crowdfunding? And then I kept putting off the writing of the actual talk for days and days and days because it was terrifying me. Finally, one day, I just sat down at my computer and I wrote the talk as I would give it if I had no time limit. And it was terrible, very nonlinear, and there were a lot of thoughts, but I just sort of vomited everything that had been floating around in my brain, vomited it out, and then called a good friend of mine who actually sort of wound up becoming my wingman in the writing of the talk, this guy, Jamie Ian Swiss. And I had made a list of TED Talk helpers, people I expected to sort of be my focus group and my soundboard. My husband, my best friend Anthony, my landlord, a couple of other people who I knew I was going to trust with the talk when it was sort of in its fetal form and I could trust them to give me really honest feedback. So Jamie Ian Swiss is this guy I actually only recently met. I met him last summer, and he understands TED and TED culture, and he's given many talks like this, and he's a professional magician. He was just the perfect person to call and say, I'm going to lay this on you. Tell me what you think. Because he gave me brutally, brutally honest feedback. And we timed that first draft that I had just sort of written in stream of consciousness, and it was about 27 minutes.
Wow.
Well, and this was also back in the day when I thought I was going to make my talk maybe 6 minutes and then just play the rest of the time.
Right.
So the feedback was, you know, you've got really good material in there, but we're going to need to do a lot of cutting. And then the next month was just this arduous process of distilling and distilling and distilling and distilling the talk down until it was just the bare essence with as few but as poignant points as possible to illustrate the idea without losing the idea. And then things got even worse because I got the talk down to about a manageable 12 or 13 minutes.
Yeah.
And the talk really started to make sense, and it had a great flow. And I would give it to various friends over Skype or over the phone, and they would tell me what made sense and what didn't, and where, you know, I could sense that there was a point where everyone was always getting a little bit bored towards the end, where I started to get very preachy, so I sort of started cutting things out, cutting things down. And then I started getting more good ideas. And my talk went from being like a perfect 12 or 13 minutes to like going back up to 15 or 16 minutes because I just wanted to add this one little sentence and this one little anecdote. And it became so tempting to keep adding stuff.
You were basically like crowdsourcing your talk.
I was. I mean, in the later days of my rehearsing, like the week before I left for TED, some really beautiful coincidences happened. You know, a friend of mine who runs the theater department at Bard wanted to Skype about something else, and I said, hey, can I lay my talk on you? You know, and my talk had been coming in at a good 12 or 13 minutes. And all of a sudden, I did the talk for Gideon Lester, the famous dramaturg, and it was 16 minutes. And I thought, what happened? What is going on with me? And I realized, because he was a theater person and he was a director, and I really wanted to impress him, that I really over-dramatized the talk. And I kept slowing down for extreme emphasis, and it added 4 minutes to the talk, and I thought, okay, I've really learned something. And then I ran into two fans of mine in a cafe 2 days before I left for TED. I was sitting there practicing my talk and practicing, you know, I had index cards with me that I had had a bunch of, you know, notes on, but now they were useless to me because my talk was already written. And I was just sitting there going over the talk again and again in my head in this little cafe in Harvard Square. And these two girls that I knew were fans of mine walked into the cafe and very respectfully and politely took a table very far away from me so they wouldn't bother me because they'd been following my Twitter feed and knew I was working on my TED Talk. And I called them over to my table and I said, hey, I know you guys are fans. I've met you before. Do you want to hear my TED Talk? Bring over some chairs. And so I took my note cards and I flipped them over and I drew all 16 or 17 of my slides on the backs of the note cards.
You drew them as
in
as
like stick figures. In like rudimentary stick figure slides. And I put the timer on my phone on, and using my index cards as my slides, I gave these two teenage girls my talk. It was so wonderful. And it was actually the scariest practice talk I'd given because we were at this teeny little cafe table and they were 2 feet from my face, and it was very intimate and very scary to be giving this talk that was meant for a giant stage and a huge group of people very far away to people sitting right next to me. It really forced me to say what I had to say very authentically, and I learned a lot too. So all these wonderful random coincidences happened.
That day that you stood on that stage, on that crate, were you terrified? Were you nervous?
I was so nervous. And I'm a stage performer, so it takes a lot to get me nervous. But yeah, I stood up on the crate and I actually looked down at my body and saw that I was physically shaking. And I thought, oh my God, you know. Actually, if you look at the very, very top of the talk, you can see me taking this huge, deep breath. You know, I've definitely had cases of nerves, but luckily, I feel like I've had enough experience to know that you breathe a couple of times and you just dive into the cold water and it passes pretty quickly. And also, you know, out of my comfort zone as a performer and a musician, because I'm used to being in front of a very forgiving crowd with no running clock. And I'm used to, you know, improvising and screwing up and laughing and asking my crowd for forgiveness, and of course it's granted, but having to deliver a very scripted, impeccably timed talk in 12 minutes and hit all of the emotional notes, that was really challenging for me.
That's musician Amanda Palmer. She's part of our episode called Giving It Away, which you can download on iTunes or from our website, ted.npr.org. I'm Guy Raz. Thanks for listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. And let's leave you with Amanda singing her ukulele anthem on stage at TED 2013.
Sid Vicious played a four-string Fender bass guitar and couldn't sing, and everybody hated him except the ones who loved him. A ukulele has four strings, but Sid did not play ukulele. He did smack and probably killed his girlfriend Nancy Spungen. If only Sid had had a ukulele, maybe he would have been happy. Maybe he would not have suffered such a sad end. He maybe would have not done all that heroin. Instead, he maybe would have sat around just singing nice songs to his girlfriend. So play your favorite cover song, especially if the words are wrong. 'Cause even if your grades are bad, it doesn't mean you're failing. Do your homework with a fork and eat your Fruit Loops in the dark, and bring your Etch-a-Sketch to work and play your ukulele, small and fearful. Ukulele, brave and peaceful. You can play the ukulele too. It is painfully simple. Play your ukulele badly. Play your ukulele loudly. Ukulele, banish evil. Ukulele, save the people. Ukulele, gleaming golden from the top of every steeple. Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 wax, then gave her father 41. It left a tragic puzzle. If only they had given her an instrument. Those Puritans had lost the plot completely. See what happens when you muzzle a person's creativity and do not let them sing and scream. And nowadays it's worse, 'cause kids have automatic handguns. It takes about an hour to teach someone to play the ukulele, about the same to teach someone to build a standard pipe bomb. You do the math. So play your favorite cover song, especially if the words are wrong. 'Cause even if your grades are bad, it doesn't mean you're failing. Do your homework with a fork and eat your Fruit Loops in the dark, and bring your flask of Jack to work and play your ukulele. Ukulele, thing of wonder. Ukulele, wand of thunder. You can play the ukulele too, in London and down under. Play and sink and play Jacques Brel and Eminem and Neutral Milk. Tell the children, crush the hatred. Play your ukulele naked. If anybody tries to steal your ukulele, let them take it. Imagine there's no music. Imagine there are no songs. Imagine that John Lennon wasn't shot in front of his apartment. Now imagine if John Lennon had composed Imagine for the ukulele. Maybe people would have truly got the message. You may think my approach is simple-minded and naive. Like, if you want to change the world, then why not quit and feed the hungry? The people for millennia have needed music to survive, and that is why I've promised John that I will not feel guilty. So play your favorite Beatles song and make the subway fall in love. They're only 1995. That isn't lots of money. Play until the sun comes up and play until your fingers suffer. Play LCD sound system songs on your ukulele. Quit the bitching on your blog and stop pretending art is hard. Just limit yourself to 3 chords and do not practice daily. You'll minimize some stranger's sadness with a piece of wood and plastic. Holy f***, it's so fantastic playing ukulele. Eat your homework with a fork and do your Fruit Loops in the dark and bring your Etch-a-Sketch to work. Your flask of Jack, your vibrator, your fear of heights, your Nikon lens, your mom and dad, your disco stick, your soundtrack to Karate Kid, your Ginsu knives, your rosary, your new Rebecca Black CD, your favorite room, your Bowie knife, your stuffed giraffe, your new glass eye, your sousaphone, your breakfast tea, your Nick Drake tapes, your giving tree, your ice cream truck, your missing wife, your will to live, your urge to cry. Remember